This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. The solitary confinement of youth in New York, a civil rights violation. I'm pleased to have with us Professor Alex Vitale, member of the New York Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and Alexandra Corey, who is the chairperson of the New York Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights.
Thank you for having us.
Alexandra, let's begin with defining the work of the committee and what were the circumstances that brought into being this very finely detailed, important report that defines solitary confinement of youth as a civil rights violation.
We were charged with looking into a topic that we thought was current within New York State, and we decided as a committee that solitary confinement of youth was an important topic. And thus, about 9 months ago, we decided to begin to investigate it, held hearings in July with advocates and with members of various government entities. That we visited Rikers in June, and as a result, we produced this report.
Now, just the scope of the report, the focus certainly has been more on Rikers Island of late, but do you see the dimensions and the final conclusions, which we will certainly delve into, as having broader implications than the youth incarcerated at Rikers Island?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, our goal was to look at all of New York State. Unfortunately, we didn't have the resources to be able to visit all the prisons, and for most of the committee members who were residing in New York, Rikers was an easier visit. But the point of the report is to go to all of New York State. In fact, there is a bill trying to wend its way through the State House, but I understand is not succeeding, which would aim to reduce the solitary confinement of youth. The issue is pervasive within the state. The state itself has over 140 adolescent inmates in some form of solitary confinement at any given point. And the city has approximately 100 or so at any given point. So in solitary confinement, that is about 18% of the New York City docs population who are young are at any given time subjected to solitary confinement. And within the state, there are, since the 1980s, a huge number of facilities that have been built simply as SHU facilities, that is, to house solitary confinement inmates. So the issue is way beyond just the city.
What I'd like to do is, you've given us some sense of the scope of what the report you would like to have covered and the scope of solitary, but maybe we can roll history back a bit and talk about this process that led to, which of course to me seems barbaric in the extreme and antithetical to human nature, to isolate and keep for extended periods of time, or for any time that matter, particularly young people. Give us some sense of how that evolved and became a mainstay of our system of discipline.
Well, first of all, I agree with you. I think it's abhorrent that in a so-called civilized society that we put anybody in these kind of conditions. And as you know, within our report, we have found that the conditions are so devastating that they do constitute a violation of the civil rights of these youth. The Supreme Court in the 1890s concluded that, in fact, solitary confinement didn't serve any kind of purpose. And yet, sometime in the 50s, 60s, we decided that we would go back into using solitary confinement as a punishment, and it is a punishment, and thus subject to, in our opinion, the Eighth Amendment, a stricture against cruel and unusual punishment. All the experts will tell you that, especially as it concerns youth, and we've defined youth as 25 and under because the prefrontal cortex doesn't really develop until around 24 or 25, according to the experts. All the experts say that there is nothing served in any way, shape, or form but punishment, and it's a severe punishment by solitary confinement. The conditions these kids are subjected to are so severe that, in our view, it constitutes cruel and unusual punishment. because the test that the Supreme Court has imposed is one that the action or condition must be objectively serious, and prison officials must be deliberately indifferent to its harm, the harm caused by it. Well, I mean, if you see what happens to these kids who are 23 hours and usually 24 hours in solitary confinement, you know, they have an hour of recreation, but recreation is in a small outdoor pen, and they have to be up and ready to go when somebody hits, you know, tells them that they're ready to go, and they have to be strip searched in order to go out to their 1 hour of pen. Most of these are 24 hours in isolation, and the experts have all said that the effect of that is to have severe mental and emotional problems, which then becomes a problem for society again because these kids end up going back out into the streets and committing probably more crimes that will get them back into solitary confinement.
Alex, we're talking about adolescence, but is the problem any really different when we're talking about people who are 18, 19, 20, 21 in that age group?
Well, certainly, our finding was that anyone under 25 is in a particularly vulnerable condition. So I think maybe the question you want to ask is, what about people who are over 25 who are not in this important developmental stage? And I think we should be asking serious questions about the suitability of solitary confinement for that population as well. But that does fall outside the scope of our report.
So let's flesh out now what your conclusions. Let's go back to Alex Vitale and then make a round again with Alexandra Corey. What are the conclusions that you have determined as to the effects of solitary on anything from the emotional well-being to the psychological implications and certainly physical as well? Alex, what happens to kids in this state?
Well, I think there are the short-term effects of the isolation, the kind of worsening of mental health conditions, the lack of access to educational resources, but there's also the long-term implication, the interruption of a young person's development, and in some cases, you know, the worsening of existing conditions because the conditions of solitary are so problematic. And so, you know, we found, you know, young people's whose educational attainment stops, whose mental health condition worsens, who come out of solitary, you know, angry, isolated, unable to reach out for help in many cases, and a criminal justice system that wasn't really interested in addressing their often severe problems in many cases.
Professor Vitale, just to go one step further there, what happens if we don't use isolation, if we don't use solitary confinement? What needs to be done in terms of education? What needs to be done in terms of readjustment once they're in outside of that role?
Well, you know, first of all, I think the question is, you know, what's the alternative to using solitary confinement? And there are a lot of experts who deal with juveniles in incarceration settings who have developed a whole range of graduated punishments, but also positive reinforcements for positive behavior. And what we found looking in the jail was that there was very little of any of that, that basically there was solitary confinement and general population and not much in between. And interestingly, we had jail officials saying, oh, well, you know, the inmates have so many rights that we can't take that much away from them. We can't take away their toothbrushes. We can't take away their soap. We can't take away their food. In other words, they, if they could, their idea of graduated sanctions is, you know, reducing people to, you know, an inhuman condition. If the jails had full scale support services, had amenities that were developmentally appropriate for young people, then you could have all kinds of graduated sanctions. What they have now is, you know, there's a game room, and if you're good, you can get some time in the game room, but that really is not adequate. Then there's this question of what to do when they get out of solitary. We found that, you know, educational assessment, assessments of disabilities, assessments of mental health conditions were often inadequate if conducted at all, and that people are coming in with these deficits, and then these conditions are making the deficits worse.
I'd like to add on to that, if I may.
Please, Alexandra.
Yeah, we think that no incel youth confinement should exceed 24 hours at any given time. If there's somebody who's being a danger to somebody else or a danger to him or herself or herself, that person should be segregated, if you will, up to 24 hours and no more than 24 hours to cool down. Should have a mental health professional who's assessing them as to whether or not there's a need for some kind of intervention. Should then be having a counselor who can help them out. And again, as Alex said, we should be having positive programming for them, and they should rejoin the community within a very, very short period of time. As you know, the UN rapporteur on torture has called for the elimination of any solitary confinement for under 18-year-olds and a maximum of 15 days in confinement for adults. Some of these youth are going because they get a ticket for each infraction, and in New York City they get a 90-day minimum for each infraction, that is layered on to each other. Some of these kids are in solitary confinement. At least when we visited Rikers, they were there 125 days, 153 days at one time, because each time they commit a new infraction, they're there. So we think that the better alternative would be to provide them, as Alex said, with more positive programming, lots of positive programming. There have been studies done in other states where, yes, money is spent, but it's spent on positive programming, and it tends to have a better outcome.
I want to contextualize this discussion, as we were beginning to do, by getting a sense of where the U.S. stands in relationship to the incarceration and the solitary confinement of youth in relationship to other areas of the world, and as well, specifically, who are the young people that we are talking about? What are they incarcerated for, and who are they, and is there a racial component to this?
Well, as you know, the U.S. has 5% of the world's population and almost 25% of its prisoners, which people say is on par with North Korea. Right now, there are about 35,000 youth between the ages of 10 and 20 held in isolation in juvenile facilities. So that doesn't include inmates who are under 21 in adult facilities. As you know, New York is one of two states that treats 16 and 17-year-olds as adults. So you come off you're arrested, you go directly to an adult arraignment. At the arraignment, if you can post bail and go get out. Most of these kids can't post bail, and then they go immediately to the prison system and have to wait for, in that detention, for any adjudication as to whether or not they could possibly qualify as what is called a youthful offender in New York. Now, who are these kids? These kids are overwhelmingly Black and Latino kids. In New York City, it's over 94% of those who are incarcerated are Black or Latino. In New York State, it's between 80 and 90%. And that's one of the bases, by the way, that we found that there's a civil rights violation, and so far as it is obviously disproportionately affecting Black and Latinos. And of course, since there's a disproportionate number of Blacks and Latinos who are actually arrested in the system and they're going through the system, there's a disproportionate number of them who are held in solitary confinement.
A member of the Legal Aid Society, Lisa Freeman, actually indicated that as many as 90 to 95% of the youth admitted to juvenile detention in New York City are children of color. And the nature of the crimes, overwhelmingly, because that should take us into a health area rather than an area of incarceration in any event. Are they not dealing with drug convictions?
Well, interestingly enough, one of the problems in New York, and not just New York City, but also New York State, is that nobody systematically keeps statistics on who's being admitted, who's being taken to solitary, and why. I think that's also an abomination. Council member Danny Drum introduced legislation this year in New York City to have record keeping, and that passed just, I think, in August of this year. So we don't know specifically what crimes are being committed that get these kids there. We do know that a significant portion of the population at Rikers is there having not yet been adjudicated, and they're ending up in solitary confinement. But we also know that many of the kids who end up in solitary confinement in New York State, about 16% of those are going to solitary confinement for, you know, violent acts, and the rest are there for all sorts of minor infractions that get them into trouble. In New York State, there are 100 different rules that an inmate has to abide by, and you can imagine for young people, that's probably particularly hard. And so they can come into end up in solitary confinement because they talked back to an officer.
And I, if I could just add on the, in terms of who's in there and this issue of bail, we know that that Rikers, folks who are there awaiting trial, about half of them are there because they cannot afford bail of $500 or less. So these are not only black and brown young people, these are poor young people.
It's so interesting how backward we are. When I read the report, you begin to talk about the earliest use of solitary confinement in the United States being tracked back to the Walnut Street Penitentiary in Philadelphia in 1787. So talk about the theories behind the use of solitary in that context, and really where the law has taken us since.
Yes, I mean, I think the early notions were that it would be rehabilitative, that you'd be handed a Bible and while you sat there and thought about what you had done. And the Supreme Court, in, as I said, in late 1800s, decided no, that really it wasn't really rehabilitative. All it was is that it hurt people. And so, what's extraordinary is the Supreme Court has yet to consider the issue of youth in solitary as a constitutional violation. But the Supreme Court has said on a number of occasions that youth have to be looked at differently in other contexts. And so, as we've said in our report, we think that the Supreme Court, if the case were to come to the Supreme Court, would find that the imprisonment and isolation of youth is not only a violation of the Eighth Amendment, but also a violation of the 14th Amendment.
But hasn't there also been an increase in the use of solitary over the last 20, 25 years?
Yes, there has been. There's been a significant increase in the amount of use of solitary confinement. Across the nation, a number of facilities have been built simply to house isolated inmates.
Why
in
is
New
that?
York State, they've a whole slew of them were built. And one of the problems that the commissioner identified to us in New York State is that because we now have those facilities, where do you put people since we don't have the facilities where you don't have the isolation?
Why did that happen? Do you have any idea?
Well, there are a number of people who say that is a function of change in our drug laws in the 1980s and a kind of push for getting tough on crime. And that coincided also with the closing of many of our mental institutions. And so the whole confluence of events led to an increase of prisons, per se, and then the view that solitary confinement was an acceptable approach to punishment.
You know, we had over that period about an 11-fold increase in the number of people being incarcerated. That mass incarceration generated tremendous management problems for prison officials, and so they often fell back on these kinds of punitive solitary mechanisms for dealing with this huge expansion in the prison population.
There was a hearing at City Hall, and the Department of Corrections reiterated the expansion and the need for the special housing units. A very nice name for the shoes are really solitary by any other name. And I was rather taken aback by that at a time when there seems to be some greater public sensitivity about the solitary confinement of youth. Alex and Alexandra, what am I missing, or what is the de Blasio administration missing, who made some statement and made his first tour of Rikers Island, a very cursory tour, but how in the world was that possible that, if anything, they were reinforcing the need for solitary?
I think the de Blasio administration has the best of intentions, and I think it's a tricky situation because he has to balance the interests of the Department of Corrections and the unions against what the advocates would call for. Interestingly enough, when he announced at Rikers the elimination of solitary confinement for 16- and 17-year-olds, he made it very clear that it's conditional upon the Board of Corrections passing this new enhanced ESHU unit where they're going to theoretically put, quote, bad prisoners. And that unit has very little programming thought out. It has zero due process thought out. In other words, you can be just placed in that union because somebody believes you to be a violent person. And there are a host of issues that have not been thought about, but my understanding is that is a condition for the elimination of punitive segregation for 16- and 17-year-olds, which is really unfortunate because I did not think that was the view that the de Blasio administration was taking.
Mm.
You know, our commission didn't look at these issues as a commission, but speaking for myself, you know, we know that there is a serious violence issue at the island after a period in which things had improved. And I think the recent lawsuit by the Department of Justice, the exposés that have been in the New York Times and other places show that there are, you know, major management breakdowns happening there. And I think that the new leadership of the jail is struggling for a way to address the violence in a period in which they do not have the cooperation of the rank-and-file employees, and where the head of the corrections union is seen as an impediment to change in an effort to isolate his officers from any kind of responsibility for their behavior. So what do you do when you can't hold the officers accountable for excessive force, when you don't have resources for adequate programming? Then you double down on isolation and punitive segregation.
At Rikers, from 2007 to 2013, the number of isolation beds increased 61%, but the use of force incidents tripled. I understand it's like people like to use it as a discipline means, but it doesn't have an effect that anybody's looking for. And the fact of the matter is that these officers need to be trained to deal with many of these young inmates. They need to be specially trained in dealing with youth and specially trained in dealing with those with mental health, because there's a significant population at Rikers.
And one of the things that I believe is also very significant is the infractions that, and that's in quotes, that lead to special housing unit treatment, to solitary confinement. They are so often of such a de minimis nature, or people who have serious mental disabilities and infirmities. Can you speak about what your report concluded about that?
Very little. A few of the infractions are of a serious nature. Many of them are drug use related, or speaking back to a prison official, not following one of the 100 rules that exists. It's extraordinarily subjective. And if you are given a ticket to go to solitary in New York State, you're not entitled to an attorney. You are entitled to question people who may be at the facility. But most of the challenges end up being against the so-called infractor. In New York City, you're automatically entitled to a attorney. If you appeal, you're not allowed to cross-examine anyone. And the person who actually hears your case is a Department of Corrections official who is often a former corrections official. So most of the kids that we talk to say it's just not even worth appealing the case because you're not going to get anywhere, and if you do, there may be retribution.
Just to get back to what Ken had started the thread of earlier, which is, okay, what is to be done? First of all, how important is it that these issues have been labeled as a civil rights violation? How important is that politically and legally? And then how do we begin the process, and what are the recommendations in terms of place time limits on punitive segregation and excluding vulnerable populations and providing training of DOC staff?
Well, it's my hope that some of the things that we've talked about in the report will be included in the DOJ's legal actions against the Department of Corrections, that they will use that lawsuit to try to implement some of our recommendations.
Right. I think it's extremely important that it's framed in terms of a civil rights violation. I mean, advocates have been talking a lot about the inhuman aspects and the dehumanizing aspects of solitary confinement, which are extremely important. But I think it's also important to put it in a framework that is a legal framework. In New York State, People v. Fishers, which was settled earlier this year, the state entered into a stipulation to eliminate solitary confinement for 16 and 17-year-olds for 5 days of the week, meaning that for those 5 days, they will only be subjected to 19 hours in cell lockdown a day. And on the weekends, of course, it could be 23 to 24 hours. But it is a stipulation that is still being worked through and on a confidential basis. But it is these kind of legal actions that actually help to change the laws and change people's appreciation for what the issues are. We think that calling it a civil rights violation is extremely important because it is a civil rights violation, and the federal government needs to be involved in making sure that states do not abuse the rights of their inmates. The DOJ and the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York has been relying upon the federal statutes to improve conditions at Rikers, and we hope that the DOJ will expand that not only to include Rikers, but also to hit all the state and county jail and prisons.
What do you hope that the report does?
We want to change conditions, and we hope that it brings to light what is actually going on in New York State and makes people think about how we treat our young people.
At this point, we hope
it gives ammunition to those who are at the state level, for instance, who are trying to pass the HALT bill. It helps those who are seeking to raise the age in New York of criminal responsibility to 18. Hope it helps the Board of Corrections in setting rules with respect to punitive segregation at Rikers, that generally that we end up with a more humane and positive treatment of our young people.
I really want to thank Alexandra Corey, chairperson of the New York Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and Professor Alex Vitale, who's a member of that commission. And Professor Vitale, how can people get a copy of this report?
They can go to the U.S. Commission's website, and they'll see a list of recent reports on the right-hand side, and they can get a PDF of the report that way.
Thank you both for the scholarship, for the political insights. We have to begin a process of looking at things as social and mental health and physical issues and stop the draconian, punitive, continuous incarceration of our youth, and then within that, the really brutalizing treatment to their development. Thanks so much for being with us. And again, we've been speaking with Professor Alex Vitale, member of the New York Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and chairperson of that committee, Alexandra Corey.
Thank you so much, Mimi and Ken. That's a really important issue, and thank you for highlighting it.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.